I'm Levy Dalton.
And I'm Erin Scala.
And this is I'll Drink to That, a weekly behind-the-scenes look at the wine business.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
Did you ever wonder what wine was like before modern times? What your ancient ancestors may have drank with dinner? Well, archaeological evidence points to some unique drinking trends from thousands of years ago. Here's a survey of the face of wine through time. Now, before we get into it, it's important to note that thousands of years ago, they hadn't quite figured out the yeast portion of the fermenting equation, so most brews would have had several ingredients. Ancient brewers would find that they'd get a better fermentation when they added certain ingredients, like fruits and honey, which increased the yeast populations. Today, we consider wine to be a pure product, and adding things to it is seen as a bit of a sacrilege. Wine additions are regulated and many are illegal. But understanding the science of fermentation has allowed us to be more selective. Thousands of years ago, this wasn't the case. First, let's go back 9,000 years to the world's oldest evidence of a wine-like product. An excavation site known as Jiahu on the banks of China's Yellow River shows us many insights into the past. This area was the birthplace of Chinese culture and the earliest evidence we have of a fermented grape product. When scientists analyzed the chemical imprints left on the inside of the Jiahu jars, they discovered three telling substances. First of all, tartaric acid. Now, this can indicate many things, but they narrowed the list down to hawthorn and grapes after they found seeds from both of these fruits at the site. They also found chemical imprints from beeswax, which indicate the presence of honey, and they found photosterols, which indicate rice. So one of our earliest fermented grape beverages most likely also contained hawthorn fruit, rice, and honey. Now, of course, the grapes used in this beverage grew wild, and they were of a different species than Vitis vinifera, most likely Vitis amarensis. Now let's head to about 6,000 to 5,000 BC. We're still way back in time, and we'll come to the legend of Jamshid. I've heard many versions of the Jamshid tale, some with racier details than others, but it goes something like this. King Jamshid lived in Persia, and he loved grapes. He stored jars of them in his palace, and when one jar spoiled, it was labeled poison. Now, we're not sure if he labeled it poison because he thought it was poison, or if because he was trying to keep people away from his sacred wine. One of his concubines, suffering from an ailment, in some versions it's a heartache, in other versions it's a headache, drank the poison to kill herself. But she became drunk instead and went to Jamshid and made amends with him. Archaeologic evidence at nearby Tep Malian supports that a wine product was being drunk during this time period and was possibly made from grapes that were grown in the Shiraz Mountains. Now let's travel to ancient Egypt. About 3150 BC, we're in the tomb of King Scorpion I. Now, this dude's tomb is huge. Three rooms of the tomb are filled with clay jars which contained wine. But this was wine that we would never recognize. It was an imported product and came most likely by sea from Jordan. Some of the clay jars were painted with contrasting stripes that looked like tiger skin. The wine was resinated, and sliced figs were suspended in the jars, either to help with fermentation or to augment the taste. Other additives found in the wine included coriander, mint, sage, and thyme. Scorpion I's interest in wine led future Egyptian kings to invest in winemaking, but domestic growth didn't get started until a few hundred years later. Now let's stay in the 3rd millennium BC, but let's head north into the Mediterranean. What were the average people drinking? Here, an excavation site on the island of Crete revealed that even the average farmer had large jars of resinated wine. So wine in the ancient world is a far cry from what wine has become today. Consider the outcry in the 1700s when England discovered that port producers were adding elderberry juice into wines. This led lawmakers to force everybody to rip up elderberry trees in the Douro. The last stand for mixed fermented beverages these days seems to be the realm of beer, where hops and flavoring agents abound. But imagine a future archaeologist analyzing our wine bottles of today. Would they find a pure grape product? Or would their chemical analysis reveal all sorts of additives that we culturally pass off as preservatives? And imagine how they'd scratch their heads if after analyzing a wine cellar, they came across a bottle of Amaro. Next time you take a sip of Amaro, imagine your King Scorpion the First of Egypt, because he might have been drinking something a little bit similar in his day, thousands of years ago. Hi there, it's Erin Scala. I do the warm-ups here at the podcast, so you might recognize my voice, and I'm the head sommelier at the Musket Room in Soho, New York. As all of you know, one of the least glorious and time-sucking things that we do is the dreaded paperwork. It's not just about being on the floor, but it's about crossing your T's and dotting your I's behind the scenes. Well, 750 really helps me with that. They have this online credit application where you only have to fill it out once, and then you can send it to any of their distributors that you wish. It saves me time, and I can spend more time on the floor with the guests opening wines. Thank you, 750.
Roberto Paris of Il Buco and Il Buco Alimentari on the show today. Hello.
Hello, everyone. Nice to see you.
You were born in Umbria.
Yes. About 60 years ago. I'm from Umbria.
What was it like at that time?
Well, it was a very poor country. It was after war. Italy. So I grew up in a countryside, in a farm where there was no water or electricity, by the way. So I have great memories of a country life, based on things that now seem so a commodity, great natural living, I would say, based on game and gardening, olive trees. I come from an olive trees region, more than wine. My areas of Umbria was about olives and olive oil. So it's a great environment, uphill mountain area.
And you started working in wine bars?
Well, after, I was a student, I went to the university, and then at one point I needed to make a living. My family was a bit of a humble origin, so I needed always support myself. So around the age of 20, 22, I started working discos as a bartender, whatever it meant. And then at one point, the first serious job of my life, I contracted a bar for 3 years within a tennis club. But there, was my first adventurous approach with the beverage in the industry. So apart from making cappuccino and all this Italian traditional thing would have been too boring for me. So I became I started exploring. There were many people of my generation that were open to try different things. So I started bringing in specialty beers, imported microbreweries from Germany, not much from Italy at that time. Today is an explosion of microbreweries from Italy, but in the 80s, when I was doing this in Italy, it was just, kind of industrial bottled beers. So I started bringing beers from all over Europe. And that was my first step into, and given the response, I expanded to wine. So, don't just Prosecco or Moscato, just start pouring interesting varietals from Alto Adige or Umbria itself, of course. Now, within Umbria, I start visiting wineries. So that was my first exploration of the wine world, mainly my neighboring cities. My hometown is just 5 miles away from Montefalco, which is now kind of a renowned wine region of Italy. So I started visiting wineries, hosting a little wine tastings in my own little bar. And that's how I started getting comfortable with the idea of working with wines.
And where did that take you?
Well, apart from that, later on I started resuming studies, so I traveled, I moved to Germany, with intention, honestly, to become a teacher. I wanted to teach Italian abroad instead of film history. That's my passion together with jazz music. But in order to support myself again in my studies, I was working in bar and Kneipe and wine bars in Germany, and so I start visiting the Rhine Valley and the Pfalz and the Mosel, developing a palate for great Rieslings. That's like in Austria, because by then I was lucky enough to know Austrian friends. My girlfriend was Austrian. So she was from Wachau, and I had an amazing, you know, revelation. I started drinking wines, and still today are my favorite wines to drink, you know, aromatic varietals from very difficult wine, but, you know, very heroic wine areas like, you know, Germany or Austria. So there was like, but still was more like an interest, a passion, an education of the palate. Definitely becoming a professional was not in the picture yet. You know, I was like using it for my job, but mainly, you know, research and exploration of life and geography. I'm very much interested in the component of sense of place and history related to wine. You know, wine, we get the end product on the shelf, but there is so much behind. And that's exactly what really tickles me, what really triggers my interest, knowing the area where the wines come from, people who make it, what they eat with their wines. Just the whole, no, the whole complexity, not just the bottle of wine. And so that interest never failed to propel me in my research, in my explorations. So I lived in France for 6 months. You know, I didn't have much money, so I couldn't go to Champagne or to Burgundy and, you know, spend a lot of money. But still, you know, I was tasting things and looking around, trying to talk to wine people, winemakers mainly. For me, that's the highest point of my experience with a wine, when I meet a winemaker, the people who make the wine. That's where I get the most of my information, and the excitement, actually, to, you know, to go ahead and confidently have the wine in a wine list. You know, that's what really makes me really excited about it.
And eventually you moved to the States. How did that come about?
Oh, well, prior to coming to the States, I went back to Italy after my life in Germany. And for the first time, actually, I was involved with a wine bar. My friend, one of my best friends, and I actually opened a wine bar, and I was his sidekick. Again, there was a situation in which I was more a volunteer than anything else. But there, my wine knowledge really took a big jump. First of all, was the year in Italy where the so-called renaissance of indigenous varietal was taking place. It was in the 90s. And apart from major giants like Piedmont and Tuscany, everyone else was really, you know, drinking local. But then all of a sudden, thanks also to the slow food movement and to some, you know, enlightened university programs in Milan, the indigenous varietals of Italy actually got the attention, and the winemakers started pre-planting or planting what was there to start with. So it was the years of the birth of the Sagrantino, of the Aglianico, or Primitivo, and that led me and my friend and I to visit all these wine areas. And you know, that's when I met Elena Pantaleoni almost 3 years ago, 25 years ago, going to Sicily, where my friend is from, Campania. So that's where really my wine knowledge became solid. And also I started, you know, making profitable, so that we were selling wines. So we were supporting ourselves, you know, so our knowledge was not just enough to drink with wine, or to be excited about something, but it was also about, you know, supporting ourselves. So then eventually in 1994, I moved back to the United States. I had a resident visa that for many reasons, mainly personal, I couldn't use because I was in some solid relationships and I couldn't leave Italy. But I moved to New York and started really working another business. I didn't want to be in people-related business. And but one day by chance, I read an article in New York Magazine where I found out that my childhood and high school friend was actually kind of missing in action. But he was actually in New York. He had opened a restaurant, which was Il Buco restaurant. So we reconnected. At the beginning, we were just hanging out. And I remember Alberto Valle, my friend, and Donna Leonard, you know, we were kind of hanging out maybe every now and then. But there was no intention from either side to make a move toward me joining the restaurant. But a couple of years later, mainly due, you know, becoming acquainted and especially Donna getting to know me and finding out that I knew something about Italian wine, even though I didn't have any restaurant experience, you know, we came to the point that I would join the restaurant in 1997. It was meant to be for a short stint, but it lasted over 15 years. So, you know, at the beginning was kind of, you know, almost difficult because I was used to jobs where there were two or three partners or myself alone. And now I'm in a situation where there are, you know, 50 employees, big kitchen, even though Il Buco by then, even now, is not a large scale restaurant, but there will be still like so many people to deal with. My experience was a bit limited. So it has been interesting to get used to the pace and to the intensity of a New York restaurant. But eventually, you know, my knowledge was enough to make me, you know, useful within the restaurant. At the beginning, was a bartender, sommelier, because the wine list was really tiny. And then I started stepping up, you know, acquiring new duties and new skills, because it was about skills too. And, you know, it has been growing ever since, you know.
Who are some of the people that were working with you at Il Buco?
Well, looking back, you know, it has been an amazing, interesting scenario because I've been lucky enough to meet, and I was already friend with Jonathan Nossiter, who was the first curator of the list. We were friends because I love movies, and I met him at a couple of movie festivals. And then we discovered that he knew people in Umbria. I knew. He knew Gian Piero Bea and another winery. So we became, you know, pals. So when actually the first time that Donna Leonard realized that I could have been an interest for the restaurant was that when I joined her and Jonathan for a wine tasting, but she didn't realize we knew each other. So that's the first time. And Jonathan was about to, you know, his movie career was taking off. By then, he had not won the Sundance, or maybe he just won Sundance. So he started being really not having enough time to dedicate to the wine list of few restaurants. So, but you know, but there was enough the first connection, and then later on, when my duties started growing, we needed a sommelier on the floor, and that's when Bill Fitch came on board. And he brought all his passions and his kind of humble, you know, he's very coy about his knowledge, but he was like a huge, passionate person, especially knew a lot about French wines, which were not my forte, and domestic wines. You know, he was coming from the West Coast, so I remember our conversations about Oregon wines and French, you know. He was the first one to introduce me to Dumas de Gassac from France or some great Morgans or Loire wines. And you know, that in that way, the list was really getting richer because the influences were many. Like, you know, my main goal was to maintain the list, you know, run the program. But it was an open field, so whoever was coming on board with a great idea, I tended to embrace it, whether they will stay or not, you know. Eventually, Bill also moved on to other lives. He moved, he moved to France with his wife. Also, in the same time, at one point, Savio Soares, who is now the importer and owner of Savio Soares Selection, was there as a GM, as a service director GM. And that was already another wild acquisition for the restaurant. There were days in which we had, you know, since there is a budget, we had to trim it down because the three of us, we were so passionate about all our, you know, area of interest that it was hard to pin down what to bring in for the restaurant. You know, eventually the restaurant was still an Italian restaurant. And 80% of the sales were Italian, but the excitement about other grapes and other regions was there. And, you know, I was all about being exposed to new things and to learn and to embrace new things. You know? So it was those years between 2000, 2002 were really the foundation of what Il Buco became later on.
And what did that look like? What did Il Buco become?
Now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's become more mainstream. I have to say that there has been a decisive moment when I left in 2009 for my overdue break that turned out to be almost a 4-year hiatus, that it's more organized, well managed, but, you know, with more management. At one point, I think that there has been an attempt to make it more solid financial. I don't know, but, you know, something happened in the wine prices, which, by the way, I readjusted as soon as I took over the full control of the list a few months ago. But, you know, there's been, like, I would say more mainstream, but my perception of Il Buco, which is still the same, that it's sort of an entity, sort of an animal, that can only be embraced, and whoever has been trying to change it failed miserably. It's a place with an extreme energy. The owner and I always agreed on the fact that the restaurant has a soul. It's hard to describe, and so that certain je ne sais quoi that it's hard to pin down, because we did a lot of things right, but sometimes not, but still the restaurant is prospering, is packing. The day I was leaving, some people were predicting that the restaurant would fall down. It didn't, you know. And I was the one said, "Don't worry, it's gonna be doing fine. It's been doing fine with and without everyone else, and that shouldn't be my case." Of course, you know, I love the restaurant more than my own. If I have a restaurant, I will love it less. That's the thing. That's where I spent most of my life, my adult life in New York, and was more than a job, was a community. Community that I always took pride on making it a good place to be, a good place to come to work, because I would hate to be in a place where people can't wait to leave. You know, for some reason, actually the opposite happened. People will never leave. They will never move on. We will be together. Like, and it was really true. True family, true community, and you know, I'm really proud to have been hanging out with such a great group of people. You know, I was in the position to make room for some servers or floor managers, and accommodate them, not financially, but to make sure that they would have a life besides the restaurant life, so they could graduate, so they could raise the kids or take a 2 months job and come back. So when I was in a position to decide that, that always happened, you know, because I always believe that it's always better to have someone talented around 2 months a year than not at all. So, you know, even though sometimes it costed me some time, I had to fill in or I had to be inventive with the schedule, but I always try to make it what I believed it is, a true community. And I would say this still is. Still Buco is that. It survived many things. And still packing every night. And still making, you know, making people happy. Diners are happy to come back, you know, consistently.
So your first tenure there, you developed into wine director and gentleman.
GM, yeah. And well, for whatever. I mean, it's titles are a bit an empty word because a GM has to have some back of the house skills that I didn't have. My mom didn't make me an accountant, that's for sure. But two things for sure I think I nailed down was the wine program and the running of the team. I think we had one, a very exceptional team. Many of the team members, which were waiters, now are wine directors, owners of wine shops, owners of restaurants, managers, and they all developed, you know, into something beautiful. But I think I take some pride in saying that I managed to keep them around. And that was making the restaurant really rich, not just in food and wine, but the human factor. Today, when I see restaurants opening, I see that this hiring of new staff is always the last thing to do. For me, it's insane. I mean, if I ever open something, I would say, first I need to figure out who's going to work with me, and then decide what I open. And that's how much I believe in the human factor. Because eventually we are in the hospitality, you know, especially, I'm more the keen on small size establishment. When it gets too big, I feel like I'm misplaced, you know, I'm out of my element. But, you know, Il Buco was the right size. It was like 30 to 50 people, employees. It was like more or less my own turf.
Because you told me once you were in the people business, not the wine business.
Right. That's what I believe in. It's like, you know, it's about people. People who work in the restaurant, who own the restaurant, the chef who cook. It's like, it's definitely my biggest attachment to the profession. It's about people. You know, look how many places in town open and with great food, great ambiance, great wines. But there is an element missing. And that element is the human factor. And that's where I think where Il Buco excelled during the years, making people feel comfortable, recognized. It's like something I thought when I came to the United States, that was impossible to replicate in the United States. Because in Italy, it's normal. In Spain, it's normal. You go to a restaurant where your parents have been, where there's been weddings, your kids baptized, you know, confirmations. Like, there's a sense of community and continuity, especially in the smaller towns. And I thought that in New York, will never be the case, but it's not true. Even New Yorkers are almost crying for something like that. So when even, you know, very famous people, they see that they get recognized and treated like who they are, not just celebrities, they appreciate it. And that's what I think Il Buco has been good at during the years.
But you did a lot of interesting things with wine.
Yeah.
One of the things you did was to bring Sagrantino into focus for New York.
Well, that was like almost a match made in heaven. I came to New York when there were only two Sagrantinos in the city. So the first acquisition I made, actually there was only one in the city, it was Bea with Rosenthal. Then the second acquisition was Capri, but it was in New Jersey, so we had to bring it over from New Jersey. It wasn't distributed in Manhattan yet. And since then, both wines have been featured on the wine list. But this is the anecdote. Those two wineries really compete with each other in many levels, also personal level. So most likely, if a restaurant is carrying Bea, will not carry Capri. I made sure that the both understood that, you know, this is my house. And I feature both of them. The reason why I do that, because they represent two different takes on the grape, on the terroir, and in the community. So starting with that in 1997, I end up in 2009, when I left, I had a reserve list of its 13 producers, 27 vintages, you know, mixed and probably the largest Sagrantino selection outside the outskirts of Montefalco. And honestly, it wasn't just a museum showing stuff. We have been really good in selling the wine. I mean, during the years, people were coming to Il Buco as a destination. They knew they would find Sagrantino, Montefalco, or Umbrian wines in general. It was a good bet, I would say. It became really easy for me. At one point, we even imported our own wine. I mean, a friend winery, you know, through a broker. So we did, you know, there have been articles written. There was attention from wine bloggers. And through the Sagrantino, actually, I met some remarkable people, like Alice Firing, Jeremy Parsons, and now are noted bloggers or wine writers. So we became friends. But really, they came to the restaurant because they knew they could find some interesting wines that were otherwise not available.
And let's talk about that a little bit, because you were also early into bringing natural wines into the New York restaurant right. marketplace. Mm-hmm. What we would now call natural wines, which right. then didn't have a name.
Right, exactly. I mean, I remember it was sometimes things that I would find what to look for. I remember once one of the importers of Angelino Maule and Pico and his wines was really struggling moving the wine. I said, what can I do? I cannot move. I said, make me an offer I can deal with. So I bought the Pico, like decent amount, like 20 cases, and I put it by the glass. At the beginning, the staff was like, this is crazy, this is insane. So I was trying, testing the wine, suggesting. Mainly with the staff, I've been always making them relax. There is nothing to fear. People don't like it, we take it back. Or it needs to be playful. You know, it's like we are exploring, we are checking our boundaries together. And it should be fun. I never understand when wine is made so difficult. You know, for the drinkers, for people who work in the wine, should be first fun. If it's not fun, can be changed. There is no attachment. You know, so it did work out. It took little time. First week was difficult. The second, and then eventually the wine started selling. The staff were more confident. They knew. How to talk about it, to present it. That was like one case. And then, of course, Tondonia wines by the glass. I always believe that the true task is to move wines like this by the glass. Because in the wine list, they're there. Someone who knows them comes in, he picks them. But if they are by the glass, the exposure is much wider. So the impact is much higher. That happened with when Gravner was making a red wine, which was no sulfites already then, and the importer didn't know how to move it. Even there, I put all the red by the glass, and it did very well. It went on for 6 months. Unfortunately, he decided not to make red anymore and not to import it anymore, but probably will be at the prices that will be not... suitable by the glass program. So there are a few examples like that, Radicon. But, unfortunately, I love natural wine movement, but sometimes it comes out to prices that is really hard to move. Nowadays, we have, I'm currently pouring Elena Pantaleoni wines by the glass or Arianna Occhipinti, which is really... They really make it easy for us to, apart that the public is open for them, but it's really easy for us to figure out how to move them, to propose them. Otherwise, if they are $200 in a wine list, they will sit there for a long time. And even people like them, they're not going easily that direction. So it needs to be affordable. But luckily, there is an explosion of the offer in the market. The biggest difference with 4 years ago when I left and now is like there are at least 10 companies that comfortably and affordably are bringing wines that fun, beautiful to drink, And, you know, and anyone can afford it, whether they are from Loire or from Collioure or from Spain, doesn't, or Greece, doesn't really matter. It's a beautiful time to be in New York now. But what I'm really interested on is to offer a wide selection of wines without being confined in one area. Like, you know, so my wine list reflects more or less my palate and my judgment. But I'm like, somebody asked me, said, do you put the orange wines in your own selection, in your own section? I'm against it. I like, you know, every wine should be divided by region. Nowadays we do it by region. And, you know, and we can explain whoever wants to know what wines are. But also I like to have the chance to have people trying a wine without knowing that it's natural. And I appreciate it. You know, it doesn't have to be that label offered. And right now at the Alimentari, I think we have about 40% wines that could be defined natural, whether without sulfites or biodynamic or organic. And they all do very well. And none of them exceeds the $90 in the wine list. So it's like between 50 and 90. It's reasonable and it's enjoyable, you know, for everyone.
You were the type of manager that was known for a hands-on style when you were the GM before. Mm-hmm. Kind of guy, no concern was too small. It's what I tend to hear from people who work with you. How did that evolve into be your style? And then what were the effects of that?
Well, right. You know, just you said the magic word. Nothing was not my concern. It's like, so I was saying before that on my desk for a while I'd written my motto was from toilet paper to champagne. And because, you know, I was around, so there was nothing that I wouldn't do. I mean, I cannot cook, likely so I never went. but I would have been cleaning if it was necessary. But that's part of my upbringing, also the fact that I worked for a long time on my own. My first experience in the world of making money and supporting myself, I had to do everything. You know, not just the shiny aspect of, I mean, everyone likes to be a wine director, but then there is the glassware and then there is the dishwasher that doesn't work. And then there is like, it's a, you know, it's a chain of things that you need to keep under control. And I always did it without any problem. I mean, that was like, again, it has to do with the fact that my first few jobs were really hands-on. I was supposed to do everything. I was on my own or with another partner. So that transferred really easily. Sometimes it got out of hand. So I had too many things to do at the same time. And as we all know, sometimes end up not doing everything perfectly, you know. But the good intentions was always there. I also learned how to delegate later on, you know. Luckily today, nowadays, I have probably the cushiest position ever. I'm a wine director for both restaurants. One, Buco, I supervise, Alimentari, I totally run the program. It's probably, you know, where I should be now at my age, because what I did 20 years ago probably today would be unsustainable. You know, it's a lot of physical work. I mean, restaurant work is very heavy on the body. Long hours standing, you know, bad sleep, bad. You don't know when you eat, when you know when you go to sleep. So right now I think I have a more appropriate function.
But you took a break for a bit. You were the GM and then you decided to go.
Right. In 2009, I came to the point that I was really tired. I got sick a couple of times and my doctor was telling me that I was taking a bad direction. I mean, it's, you know, nothing really bad, but so, you know, I came to the point to take a 3-month sabbatical and I left an assistant behind and other managers, but somehow things didn't work well and other people were hired. And after 3 months, during a conversation with the owner, she told me, you know, if you want, you can take 3 more months. I said, fine. It's like, you know, I went up and hiked the pre-Himalaya and then Nepal. It's like I went crazy. So it was like free like a bird and big rush of adrenaline. And then I came back in June 2009 to see what July, how things were looking. And honestly, we all agreed on one thing, that the restaurant could go ahead without me, and I could go ahead doing other things. In the meantime, during my travels, I'd met my current fiancé, hopefully wife soon. And so my traveling took another level. I moved to Thailand for 3 years, about 3 years. Coming back and forth to Europe, trying. I had some summer gigs and in a very fancy resort owned by a very well-known Hollywood director, who I'm not supposed to mention. But so that was like, you know, giving me like 2 or 3 months in Italy, which was also needed because I've been away for too long. You know, I needed to be closer to my family, to my brothers and sisters and nephews. Like, so, you know, that's been an interesting ride. I took on meditation. I hiked many mountains. And mainly today, I say the most important aspect, I found a private situation that it was not available in New York for me. I never made it, or maybe because I was working too much. So now I have this, treasure. I treasure this companion very much. This is my girlfriend, fiancé. So, I couldn't foresee that, of course. When I left in March 2009, it was all about, taking a wild ride and traveling and doing things I was planning for a long time. But then it went to another level. So I started settling down in a country that I never really, I love it, but I never planned to go. So I end up being in a place that I couldn't imagine before.
Thailand,
yes. And there is like, it wasn't very nice detour from my usual self. I mean, I didn't touch alcohol for a year and a half since I was doing meditation. I went to monasteries a few times. Of course, I sailed, I've been diving. I mean, enjoying a very affordable life, great food, great weather, all together, an amazing package. And honestly, I was really pretty happy. Probably the most time I spent in a city has been like every now and then a few days in Bangkok, because I'm in the countryside. In Italy, I'm the countryside. It's just, big cities somehow get to my nerves. It's just too much for me. Like I like a more a suave, a more quiet lifestyle. I don't get bored easily. Of course, I had plenty of time for my readings, I'm an avid reader. I read almost anything I find. Sometimes when I find myself like addicted, I go to a supermarket, I read the labels. This is my joke, but I have this. I love to read. And having so much time, made me reading and keep on going, writing my journals, and fun. But for that, you need time. If you're in New York and you are 16, 14 hours a day, in a restaurant, you have no time. You're always running around, responding to demands of other people, whether it's anything. It's great. I can do it. I love it. But I also love the opposite. It's brought balance in my life. So it finally, I took care of other things. Then last year, in February, on the verge of the 3 stars for the alimentari, the owner of the restaurant, Donna Leonard, and Ersano Akin, who's almost like a nephew to me, came to visit me in Thailand. And during our vacation, we discussed the possibility for me to come back to help out with the new baby, which is a giant baby.
Because there was another restaurant.
Yes. In the meantime, while I was away, the attempt to open a restaurant finally, another restaurant finally worked out. It didn't work well. I mean, it was always in the picture, but there was never enough favorable condition. So finally the condition came to place. And I didn't come into helping out until the first 6 months of life. So the restaurant was open in September 2011. I was here actually for the inauguration. And then on February, there were the 3 stars from the New York Times, and the business just exploded. And that's when was the time when the owner was in Thailand with me, and you know, looking at the picture and how overwhelmed almost everyone was. You know, she said, you know, will you please consider coming back? So we found an agreement, but the agreement was about coming on board, fostering new managers. Like that, her idea was like, oh, you have been around so long, you know me, you know the restaurant, so you can bring your experience, you know, your insight. But the fact is that whoever was working and was supposed to foster and let grow quit for a reason or another. They moved on. They took another job. The wife moved, got a job in another, in California, whatever. For whatever reason, people didn't stay. And so once again, I got stuck with with a myriad of things to do. And it lasted until this. And actually, at the beginning, I wasn't even dealing with the wine because there was another wine director who took over the wine list, the wine programs when I left, Paul Lang. And so I was contributing. But really, my main task was running the restaurant, you know, floor manager, general manager, working closer to the director of operation, who's a dear friend. But then again, everyone moved on. Paul Lang moved on. My friend, director of operation, Alfredo Ruiz, moved on. So it took about until July 15th this year that I've been, you know, juggling with even beyond my own capacity, with almost everything was needed to deal with. And consider Alimentari is like 3 times the size of Ibuco. I mean, in terms of covers, like, you know, it's gigantic. It's like a giant machine that rolling from 9 a.m. to 1 a.m. or midnight, and big kitchen, very successful. The food is fantastic.
But I had a great meal there. Like, genuinely great.
Yeah, I know. I mean, honestly, the food has been the shiniest aspect of the restaurant. Little by little, again, you know, I took over the wine program for good on May, and you know, making arrangements. So the wines are, you know, moving along. Like, my goal is to present wines that go well with the food. Once considered that the star is the food, I want to bring in wines that complement that food. Never to forget that the wines are important because you are in the food industry. So, you know, then I'm not, even though I may consider, I'm not interested in big, you know, super Californian Cabernet, because they just wouldn't fit the profile. You know, like wines, food wines, affordable food wines. So that's one thing. And the other thing that I finally, with the right people coming on board, I'm relieved of managerial duties. But it's just fresh. Up until mid-July, I've been dealing. And I'm not saying that I've been dealing that successfully. Sometimes I end up doing things I really don't have a clue about. So, you know, like, so it's now the operation is really big. You have 2 restaurants, 150 employees. It's not a small little, you know, NoHo restaurant anymore. No, it's a big company. It presents a lot. So I like to play my role and within the restaurant, respecting everyone at its position. And we're getting there. Again, Alimentari has been an amazing story too, but a totally different one from Ibuco, you know. It's a big project, investment, investors, a lot of things at stake. So while Ibuco took a long time to build, it's privately owned, it's all paid. So it's almost like, you know, a no-brainer. It has the opposite problem eventually that needs a little rejuvenation. but it's really well settled. Alimentari needs a lot of attention from all of us. Like, it's growing really fast. It grew really fast, almost too fast. And but again, you confirm that the food is fantastic there. So we are all making sure that every other aspect of the restaurant gets to that level or closer to that level. Service, wines, you know, and the organization overall.
You've been friends and worked with Donna Leonard, the owner of Il Buco and Il Buco Alimentari, for a number of years. Right. What is she like?
Well, I had the chance to say that many times. I probably would have been not lasting so long. She would have been less committed and demanding. The way I am, you know, the respect, apart from being, we developed friendship, you know, we are like, again, she calls myself uncle to her son. But the truth is that her commitment to excellence is was really made me stay for a long time. So because it was like a challenge, an inspiration. It also did match a part of me that sometimes I didn't know I had. Well, you know, I've been a marathon runner. I know what it takes to push it. And so I used that kind of character in my job too, you know, a sportsman job, like that you don't give up, that you show up to work every day improving. So that really is probably the best affinity we have. That she wants, no matter what, she's been around. It's not about money. People think it's about money. Restaurant business, sometimes, if you break it down, it's not even worth it. I mean, if you break down the work and the troubles and and the efforts you have to put there, if you really want to make money, you're better off investing your money in real estate. So, and also with a big rush of failure. How many people failed miserably in spite of the great ideas, you know? So it's not, it's about really a desire to excel and not even ambition. I see the purity in this desire, in myself, in herself, in her too. Like really to create something beautiful that you can be happy with, you know? And that's really our biggest affinity. I mean, apart from a personal affection and love for each other.
And the wine world, just to bring it back to that for a second. What are you in love with in the wine world today?
Small importers, of course. I have to say that some of my old favorites are still my favorites. I'm about to schedule an event with Sergio Char from Chateau Moser, which I have the privilege to have met a few times. That's definitely still there, and nobody's going. I mean, a few people are featuring his wines, and I can only name probably at this moment Terroir and, you know, the master of Terroir, Paul Grieco, for being so passionate about this winery. So it's so some of the news are the old news. So the first thing I did, actually, I reinstated all the Moser wines in both wine lists, because they were somehow not considered not relevant by other managers, other wine directors. But that's my one of the things. The major change, actually, though, is the presence of affordable, valuable, natural wines. I mean, companies are endless to mention, but Savio Soares and Jenny and Francois offer so much value there that it's impossible not to take advantage of, whether it's from France or Italy. It doesn't really matter. Actually, what I'm really surprised of is the explosion of interest of natural, small producer of natural wines in Italy, because to my knowledge, there were very few. There were still today, they are opposed by local associations. Like, you know, they're treated like pariahs or rebels. We know about, you know, the problems that Oliver Cousin has in France, but it's the same in Italy. I'm very proud that finally, after 3 years of, I had it before, but I'm available. I don't know if you're aware, no Corrado Dottori and La Distesa wines from the market.
Very good, yeah, from the market.
5 cases of wine in the market. I probably take them all once they're in New York. So it's like, that's what gives me an enormous rush of adrenaline. No, because I met the guy, I visited the winery. I wasn't even aware he wasn't in the United States. I had once a case through Gray Market. And honestly, I ended up drinking half of it. Was too little to put it in the wine list. No,
that's the excuse you used. Yeah, it's also happens anyway, to be really good wine.
When I say drinking, it's probably if you come in for dinner and you ask me, what do you have? What do you have up your sleeve? So I say, I'll go downstairs and show up with that bottle and I test it with you. That's one of the prerogatives that to have that position, which you can have something always, hiding somewhere that can make someone special happy. You know, not everything is printed on the list. You know, that's the old timer. That's when, if you had come to my wine bar once in the 90s, we didn't have anything printed. You would come in and said, what do you feel like? What mood are you? Like, you know, so I would look around on the shelves and pick one bottle instead of another, trying. If it didn't work, we open another one. So it's like, you know, really relating to the person in front of you. That sometimes I still do in the restaurant. But again, my latest excitement is the acquisition possible, I hope soon, of La Distesa and the wines from La Distesa. And then again, some small, you know, unknown wineries that I didn't know. I have no problem saying that sometimes I'm offered wines that I didn't even know exist. It will be a sad day, the day in which I don't discover something new. You know, I think the worst that can happen to people in our line of work is to think one day that you know everything you need to know. I mean, I definitely know more wines than I can use, but I don't know everything, and I want to know every day something more. If I don't have that element, I would probably wouldn't do it. If I would become jaded and unenthusiastic about something, I would just do something else with myself.
Yeah. When I go down to the cellar in Il Buco, the original Il Buco, mm-hmm. I see amazing old wines that
hang over.
Over my head. And yeah. It's on the walls. And I say, how do you have that? And it's, Roberto's private collection. That's a gift to Roberto. What are the layers of Il Buco? From someone who's been there for so long, sometimes I hear about, you know, finding old wines that Jonathan Nossiter had put on the list back in the bowels. You know, what layers and stories and histories does that restaurant hold beneath it?
There is definitely still a lot of old Umbrians, one bottle each of old Sagrantinos. And then there is like a few years ago, I bought for a ridiculous price a case of older Mussar wines that, now, I think I checked online, it's insane expensive, but like we're talking about 68, 74, 64 reds. There are some, older Burgundies, but our budget has been always limited. You know, we are not not to mention like a Batali group, they have $1 million sellers. Our sellers is humble. So the treasures you see, they're really treasures. Sometimes they're forgotten. As you may know, it can happen also with books, right? You buy so many books and 10 years later you discover, wow, that I didn't know I had that book. So that sometimes happens with the wines, that they slip through the crack. And so there are some older Rieslings, Auslese or Baron Auslese. There are some older Grüner Veltliner. Unfortunately, in some moments in the need to deplete inventory, in my absence, they even pour by the glass stuff is like collectible, but that's a business aspect that it's a bit cruel sometimes. You know, we need to make ends. I can't criticize anyone for that, but sometimes it's like, the urge to deplete inventory makes people make some choices that are quite brutal, I would say. But, there is plenty of stuff sitting there. I have the inventory in my hand, and I was checking that there is still stuff that was there in 1997. You know, there is an older Rioja, like a 69 Rioja, that has been there since I came on board. As a matter of fact, I have an anecdote to say that when I came on board, the first time I opened La Rioja Alta, Viña Ardanza, I honestly thought it was corked. So that's like so naive, like I didn't know anything about Spanish wine. So I took the bottle back, and then the second was the same. So it was like my first impact with old Rioja wines. And then I later on, and we had like a major hysterical laugh with Jonathan Nossiter, because, you know, he said, "You really didn't know?" "No, I didn't know." So I, you know, that was my first impact with older Spanish wines. So now we have still hiding somewhere a few older vintages. But again, it's not cases. It's just few bottles of this, few bottles of that. And some of them just are being considered valuable. Some others just were in a case where everyone forgot them, or they've been found back a few years later, you know. Or maybe I did hide stuff very well once that I even forgot I put it there. So, you know, there is stuff resurfacing every now and then. But I would say that the largest depth of the restaurant is, you know, Italian. You know, we have a great depth in the Piemontese. And actually, there I noticed that the interest in all the Piemontese wines is really solid at Il Buco. We go through a lot of older vintages. And that's reassuring, because, you know, Piedmont is also an area where everyone thinks to know, but when they start drinking it, they find it too acidic, too tart. Like, everyone thinks that because of the big points, the point system is misleading everyone. People see big points and they think it's rich and fleshy, and then ends out to be really tart and astringent and acidic, or when it gets old, really light and kind of frail, you know. So but we are doing well in that department.
Roberto Paris, he knows the values that have sometimes been forgotten, and he's doing well still today after all these years. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Roberto Paris of El Buco and El Buco Alimentari.
Hey, everyone. We love your feedback, and we'd love to see your feedback in the comment section on iTunes. I know you want to tell us what you thought about today's episode. We'll see you there.
Hi there, it's Erin Scala. I do the warm-ups here at the podcast, so you might recognize my voice, and I'm the head sommelier at the Musket Room in Soho, New York. As all of you know, one of the least glorious and time-sucking things that we do is the dreaded paperwork. It's not just about being on the floor, but it's about crossing your T's and dotting your I's behind the scenes. Well, 750 really helps me with that. They have this online credit application where you only have to fill it out once, and then you can send it to any of their distributors that you wish. It saves me time, and I can spend more time on the floor with the guests opening wines. Thank you, 750.
And that's this week's episode of I'll Drink to That. You can find the show on iTunes, on Stitcher, and on our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com. No apostrophe. Thanks for listening.